Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Are unmanned drones coming to a neighborhood near you? Unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, which you've probably heard about because they're used by the U.S. military to kill suspected terrorists abroad, are now making their way into domestic airspace for civilian and police use. According to the Federal Aviation Association, there will be about 15,000 drones in U.S. skies by 2018. Domestic drone use has been reported in several states, including Texas and Florida, and many more public and private entities are trying to acquire the technology, including the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. The Department of Homeland Security is pushing for expanded drone use. According to a Hearst newspaper and Center for Responsive Politics investigation, a 60-person Congressional Unmanned Systems Caucus has received $8 million in drone-related campaign contributions over the past 4 years. But the move to populate U.S. airspace with tens of thousands of drones has raised concerns by civil liberties groups about legal and privacy issues. So is there a right way to use drones in the U.S.? Who's buying them and for what purpose? And how influential is the drone industry lobby? Well, to talk about all of this, we are joined by Jennifer Lynch, who is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and she's here with me in studio. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
And we'll later be joined by Jay Stanley with the ACLU, and we also are joined by George Schultz, who's an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Are you with us, GW?
I am. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us. Well, let's start, Jennifer, with just some basic facts about domestic drones, because I'm a little confused about what they are and how they're being used. So can you just kind of explain what kinds of drones we have?
Sure. Well, currently the Federal Aviation Administration is the federal agency that issues all authorizations to fly drones. So that means they issue drone licenses. And currently they are issuing licenses only to public agencies and public entities. So that means your state and local law enforcement agency, maybe your California Department of Forestry for fire work, some public universities, and then federal agencies like the military, the FBI, the Department of Justice. And really, there are all sorts of different types of drones being flown in the U.S. today. Everything from airplane-sized Predator drones being flown by Customs and Border Protection.
I believe he's an engineer produced.
To very small drones that you can launch just with your hands.
So how would that kind of a drone be different than a model airplane?
Well, drones are oftentimes drones are used like model airplanes, but the thing that makes them different is that, first of all, you can program in a flight plan. So you can program in something ahead of time and they can follow that plan. But also they have the ability to be autonomous. So they can route around problems, like if there's some unexpected obstacle in the flight plan, maybe another aircraft or a tree or changing weather conditions, they should be able to route around that and accommodate for that and come back to the base.
Okay, so all the way from a large airplane-sized drone that's doing surveillance on the U.S. border, what to see about so-called illegal immigrants?
Yeah, well, Customs and Border Protection says that they're using it for illegal immigration. They're also using it for drug trafficking. That seems to be a big use of drones, both with Department of Homeland Security and with the state and local law enforcement agencies.
And so what about local police forces? What are they... Well, what are they already using it for, and what do they want to use it for?
Yeah, I think what we've seen in the records we've gotten from the Federal Aviation Administration so far is that most law enforcement agencies are using drones. They're just testing them out at this point, trying to see how they can be useful. But the uses that they would like to use their drones for are like search and rescue in unpopulated areas, maybe patrolling fields, flying over fields where they suspect people are growing marijuana. And then I think ultimately they'd like to use them for surveillance purposes and for monitoring high crime areas.
And you, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, had to sue, file a Freedom of Information Act to get in all of this information from the FAA, from the Federal Aviation Administration. How long did it take to get this information? Why wasn't it public in the first place? And what did you find sorting through all of these documents?
Yeah, well, it's been really interesting. So about a year and a half ago, we really knew nothing about drone flights in the United States. We had some sort of high-level numbers of different agencies, but we didn't have the actual records of who's flying drones. And I think that's a real issue, because without transparency like that, we just don't know how people are using drones, and we don't know if they're being used appropriately or inappropriately. So about a year and a half ago, we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FAA asking for copies of all the drone license applications.
And how many were there?
Well, at that time, we didn't know. We thought there might be about 60 agencies that were licensed to fly drones, but we really didn't know. And so the FAA didn't respond. And then about 9 months later, in January 2012, we filed a lawsuit. And then we started talking to the FAA about these records. It turned out the records were voluminous. They had something like 750 applications that had been filed for drone licenses since they started their program in about 2005. And those were from all different types of agencies. The first thing they did was they gave us a list of all of the private and public entities that were authorized to fly drones, and there were about 65 public entities on that list. Everything from, you know, your small local law enforcement agency to departments of forestry to, you know, the military. And also we got a list of private entities that were authorized to fly drones, and these included drone manufacturers. Most of them were pretty large, like Raytheon and General Atomics. General Atomics is the company that makes the Predator and Reaper drones that fly here and abroad.
And how much does a Predator drone cost?
That's a good question, and I don't have figures on that, but it's in the multiple millions of dollars. And it's not just the cost of the drone, but it's also the cost to fly the drone. It's incredibly expensive to fly these things, and the larger drones.
And a lot of this is being subsidized by the Department of Homeland Security. They're funding local law enforcement to get drones. Is that right?
Yeah,
accurate?
So Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice both issue funds for local law enforcement for all different types of policing measures. And Department of Homeland Security has been interested in funding programs that somehow relate to national security or that they think should relate to national security. And as part of that, they've been issuing funds to purchase drones.
And GW, let's pull you into this. I'm wondering two things. One, the sort of history and overview of drone use in the U.S., if you know that. And then Texas, you went through the Texas Public Information Act and found out that the Texas State Police is spending millions of dollars buying drones. I think there's a $7.4 million contract with the Swiss company Pilatus Aircraft. So if you could give us a little bit of background on the history of drone use and then get into what's happening in Texas, that would be great.
You know, as far as several years back, I don't know that history extraordinarily well. I mean, private companies and the Defense Department have been experimenting with pilotless aircraft for a long time, but it's really in recent years that we saw the more rapid deployment of unmanned aircraft, first abroad, and now as the long wars are winding down, there's great interest in seeing how this technology can be utilized in the United States. The idea being, why not take advantage of this innovation and apply it for public safety purposes here, now that we've built hundreds of these things that we've used abroad in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, as far as surveillance aircraft in Texas and elsewhere, what I was really interested in thinking about this year, there's been a lot of attention paid to drones, but what I was really thinking a lot about was, where else is the surveillance technology itself being used? On the belly of a drone, the power of that technology, what it can do, how long it can be in the air, how long data can be stored from that technology, where else is it being used when a drone is not involved? And drones are somewhat sexy to us because it's such a new phenomenon in the U.S. airspace. We're talking about aircraft in the air without a pilot in the cockpit. But half this debate revolves around the sophistication of the surveillance equipment itself. So when I started to learn that law enforcement agencies around the country were beginning to invest in high-altitude surveillance aircraft, I started looking at contracting documents to see what the technology looked like. So in the case of Texas, the Department of Public Safety here has received a lot of money from state lawmakers to beef up border security operations. They've purchased gunboats with high-powered machine guns on them.
Gunboats for the air?
No, I'm sorry. Gunboats for the river, to patrol the river.
Okay, so these are unmanned
No. They're not unmanned, okay. But it's part of an array of investments that the DPS has been making for border security purposes over the last several years. So inside this big investment push Texas has been making and beefing up border security, one of their purchases was this high-altitude surveillance aircraft, and it had a pilot in it. So it wasn't a lot of folks weren't necessarily paying attention to it. Their surveillance technology on board, though, however, is very powerful and has thermal imaging capabilities, meaning they can detect sources of heat, can see large distances and see a lot of granular detail. One of the ways to think about how surveillance technology is advancing is technologies like wide area surveillance. When we think about surveillance cameras, we often think of grainy images that you see on television programs of a bank robber being videotaped and you can't see their face very well. The technology behind surveillance cameras is advancing very, very, very rapidly. In the case of wide area surveillance, it's almost difficult to fathom the expanse of the geographic area you can cover with wide area surveillance cameras. And if you're up in the air for 8, 10, 12 hours a day with either a drone or a piloted aircraft, you can cover several miles of area, then go back and look over that tape later and zoom in and see rich details about a certain area that you're interested in, a single block in the city, a car, a person walking around. And since we have the capability now to store detailed data for longer periods of time, it's possible to compile and collect this data for a long, long time. And if you're in law enforcement and public safety, that's a real value to you. Because if a crime occurs, you might want to be able to go back, look at that footage, and zoom in on an area where you know that a shooting occurred. But in the process of doing that, while law enforcement might see a real value in that, you're talking about the potential of collecting hours and hours and hours of very detailed surveillance footage that captures a whole lot of people for whom there's no reasonable suspicion they've done anything wrong.
And right now,
this is the case.
Do you need a warrant right now?
No. And you know, Jennifer understands a lot of the law around this too. But the way this works is, what the Supreme Court has said is that you can't use a thermal imaging device to, quote-unquote, look inside someone's house from above to attempt to detect a source of heat and determine if they might have a marijuana grow operation, for instance. But you and I, since we can access a public airspace and fly over someone's backyard, the Supreme Court has said, okay, police can do that same thing. And if they see a pallet of illegal weapons stacked up in someone's backyard, then they can bust them for it because it's not inside their home. But there are still nuances to this question. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has also in the past suggested that surveillance taking place for long lengths of time and surveillance involving very sophisticated technology that's not generally accessible to the public may raise Fourth Amendment questions about search and seizure. And as this technology progresses and develops and improves, much of it becomes technically available to the public. You and I aren't going to spend necessarily thousands of dollars on new surveillance cameras, but it's more accessible to the public than it was 10 years ago, something like wide area surveillance. What that means is, across these Supreme Court decisions, there's a lot of uncertainty about what police can and can't do. And that leaves the public vulnerable as far as what their Fourth Amendment rights are, and it leaves police vulnerable as well, because if they attempt to use some of this information later, data they generated from this technology later, as evidence against a criminal defendant, the defendant's lawyers might successfully manage to throw that evidence out because they've challenged it, and there's a lack of clarity about what police can and can't do.
That's G.W. Schultz. He's an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, and we're talking about domestic drone use here in the U.S. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. We're also joined by Jennifer Lynch, who's a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and she's with us here in studio. And I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're at 866-798-8255. What do you think about the proliferation of domestic drones, and what do you consider legitimate uses? What are your privacy concerns, and how do you think that they should be regulated? And what needs to be done to ensure the legality of a drone program? Our number is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. Are drones a new fact of domestic life, or can we put this genie back in the bottle and regulate it? 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. And what questions you have about how drones are being used now and the future ahead of us, you can put that to Jennifer and GW. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, the number is 866-798-8255. So talking about regulation and the politics around this, I don't know, Jennifer or GW, who wants to take this, but there's a drone caucus that has been pushing for expanded use. They signed the FAA Modernization and Reform Act, which starts to regulate some of this. What are the politics of this, of drone use?
Well, I think the politics have been really interesting to see over the last year. So the Congress did pass the FAA Modernization Act, and that act covers a lot of different things related to flights in the United States and around the world. But it does have a big section on what the FAA should be doing in regards to drones. And so there was a lot of push in Congress from the Unmanned Aircraft Caucus, these six, there are about 60 congressional members on this caucus, to really roll out drone production across the United States. So part of the
why this push
is a ton of money in this. So so you had asked earlier about sort of the history of drone use in the United States. We've been using Predator drones since 1995 in Bosnia. The U.S. government and governments abroad have been working to develop drones since before even the Vietnam War. But the interesting statistic to me, I think, is that back in 2005, about 5% of the U.S. military planes were drones, and now one in three aircraft flown by the U.S. military are drones. That's a huge increase. And as we talk about wrapping up wars abroad, if we ever do that, we have all of this technology that has to go somewhere. And this is how our technology advances. It goes from military development funded by the Pentagon, funded by private companies, and then it trickles down to state and local law enforcement. This is what happens with all technologies, and this is happening now with drones. So there's a lot of money in drones, billions of dollars. That money is coming into Congress. As you mentioned earlier, I think there were something like $8 million that have landed in the pockets of senators and congresspeople on the Unmanned Aircraft Caucus. But the interesting thing to me, I think, has been that even though Congress passed this act in February of 2012, pushing for the expansion of drone use, we've seen since that time a lot of concern on both sides of the aisle with unregulated drone use. So over the summer, three different congresspeople introduced or proposed bills that would regulate the use of drones, that would require a warrant prior to using drones for surveillance. And now there were some pretty huge holes in those bills, but at least that was a first sort of step in the right direction.
And we're joined by Jay Stanley, who's a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Glad to have you with us. You at the ACLU put out some recommendations about how to regulate drone use. Do you want to just talk about that, and are you working with Congress members to pass legislation?
Yeah, we are. And so in our report, which we put out in December of last year, 2011, we outlined sort of basic, steps that we think need to be taken, ideally by Congress, and failing that, then by states or localities, to put some rules of the road in place around the use of drones. We called for usage restrictions so that basically the police are restricted to using drones only where, A, there are specific reasons for them to believe that the drone will collect evidence of wrongdoing related to a specific instance of wrongdoing, or, B, where there is a genuine emergency. And we also We called for restrictions on image retention so that any images of identifiable individuals that are captured in the course of a legitimate law enforcement operation are rules are set up around how they are retained or shared. We called for public notice about the policies and procedures for how drones are used. Too often, these kinds of things are kept secret. It's a matter of public concern. It should be something that's publicly available and publicly, can be publicly debated. And in the same way, we called for democratic control, that deployment and policy decisions around UAVs should be democratically decided. So, what we see all too often with cutting-edge surveillance technologies is what I call policymaking by procurement. Instead of having a democratic debate about, the boundaries between privacy and police power and so forth, the police just go out and buy things and start using them with no discussion, often funded by grants straight from Homeland Security, so there's no democratic discussion around the funding process, as there usually is. Just a big pot of money plops into their laps from Washington. And then finally, we called for auditing and effectiveness tracking. If local governments are going to spend a lot of money on drones, then there should be a clear, systematic measuring examination set up so that we can find, the public can find out whether this is just, toys for boys and high-tech, neato things that the police are playing with, or whether the public is actually getting good benefits from high technology.
And are you getting a lot of buy-in from lawmakers, Jay?
We are. We're getting a very sympathetic ear. One of the remarkable things about privacy issues in general, compared to a lot of the issues that the ACLU work on, is that it really is a nonpartisan issue. There's a lot of concern about privacy issues surrounding drones and many other privacy issues from conservatives as well as from liberals. And so there seems to be a broad consensus developing around this issue, unlike so many others that I work on as a privacy advocate, that really something needs to be done. We've seen states and localities start to really pay attention to it. For example, Seattle, where there's been a lot of local discussion.
And have you been following what's happening here with the Alameda County Sheriff wanting to use a drone?
Yes, I have, at least generally. I think that it's great that there's been as much local attention to the issue as there is, because so often we see people just throw up their hands and say, oh, it's in the march of technology, what can you do? But of course, technology is under our control. We can put, technology is always channeled by protections and rules and regulations that we put in place. And, the example that I often use of that is the fact that, we do have video surveillance cameras in public places all over America, and, we at the ACLU don't really love that, but almost none of them have audio recording capability, and it's not because audio recording capability is expensive, it's because the wiretapping laws make it difficult to attach audio to cameras. And so, the technology exists, it's cheap, it's available, but we've cordoned it off, we've channeled it in accordance with our values, and we need to do that with drones as well.
And that's Jay Stanley. He's a senior policy analyst with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. He joined us on the phone from Washington, D.C. We're also joined in studio by Jennifer Lynch, who's a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And G.W. Schultz is an award-winning Homeland Security reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. We have a full bank of calls to talk about this issue, domestic drone use, and how much it's been increasing over the past few years. And we'll get to your calls right after a break. You can join us when there's an open line by calling 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments at our website, which is yourcallradio.org, and we'll have information and links to everybody who's a guest on our show today. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Radio KALW San Francisco, online KALW.org. People celebrating the season of giving, sometimes give back to the community. We hope that we've been doing that here at Local Public Radio, and you consider KALW a valuable resource. There's still time to get an end of the year tax deduction and that warm feeling that only comes when you know you're making a difference. Join Local Public Radio today. Make a pledge online at KALW.org, or you can mail a check to 500 Mansell Street, San Francisco, 94134.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll talk about what's ahead for the legalization of marijuana now that voters in Washington and Colorado have approved recreational use of pot. Friday, we'll host our media roundtable, of course. That's when we talk with journalists about the week's news. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about domestic drone use, and it's growing in the U.S. We're talking about the legal and privacy concerns. We're joined by G.W. Schultz, who's an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He joins us from Austin, Texas. We're also joined on the phone from Washington by Jay Stanley. He's a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. And here in studio is Jennifer Lynch. She's the staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I'm going to go to all of your calls. Thanks for your patience. First, let me read an email from Dolores. She says, documents obtained by the Electronic Frontier Foundation reveal that military drones, including Reaper and Predator drones used in Afghanistan and Iraq, are already flying over the U.S. So all drones are subject to hazards, including software and mechanical failures that can result in catastrophic crashes or interference with other air traffic. Can you talk about those concerns, just about airspace and hazardous material, et cetera?
Yeah, well, this is a huge concern, and actually this plays to the FAA's strengths. I mean, the FAA as an organization was created to maintain safety in the national airspace, and that's really what the agency has been doing. And there have been a lot of complaints from state and local law enforcement and federal agencies that the FAA is moving too slowly on integrating drones. But the real reason is because a lot of these drones are pretty unsafe. The Predator and Reaper drones have been flown by the military so much that probably their incidence of failure and crashes are not as high as some of the smaller drones that don't have the same kind of sense and avoid technology built in. But one of the documents that we got from the U.S. Air Force is an operational risk analysis report for Predator and Reaper drones. And these drones are being flown. They're flown all over the country in restricted airspace over military bases, but they're also flown in the national airspace, which means they're flown over our communities as they're transported in between military bases and for other reasons. And anyway, this document that we got, this risk analysis document, focus specifically on Predator and Reaper drones flown in the New Mexico area, and it looked into some of the crashes and some of the reasons why a drone could fail. And there really are all sorts of reasons. They could lose a connection between the pilot on the ground. They could have the same kind of mechanical failures that a regular aircraft could have. And I think that it becomes a little bit more scary to think of failures like that with a drone because there's no pilot on board. The pilot is on the ground, and that's the big distinction with a drone.
And let's go to some of our calls. Let's go first to Anonymous in Oakland. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. I find this whole, the guests, what they're talking about, very disturbing, very troubling. I want to dig myself into a hole and never come out. It's just another reason to be ashamed to be a citizen in this country. To me, we're going around the problem. We're being allopathic, dealing with symptoms instead of dealing with holistic causes, getting to the root causes of why people feel that they have to use such evil weapons against other people, to surveil, to kill, to maim, to do any series of horrendous things around the world, and in this country. I am very, very sick and tired of being a citizen in this country. I am ashamed. It's very chauvinist. It's very macho, patriarchal. And I think you get the gist of my message.
Got it. Thank you very much for calling. Let me put that to our panel. What do you say to citizens who are feeling a little bit powerless along these lines? What do you advocate that people do who are concerned about privacy issues?
Well, what we've been advocating at EFF is that people talk to their local law enforcement. And I think that, like Jay and GW were saying earlier, it has really made a difference. The one thing about drones, for good or for bad, is that you can see them and they look kind of scary. So unlike other types of surveillance, you can see what they look like. And I think that has made people much more concerned about drone surveillance than we've seen in other types of surveillance technology. And so people have been going to their local city council, to, for example, the Alameda Board of Supervisors and protesting drone use. And that has had a real effect here in Alameda County. The county sheriff was going to purchase a drone with a combined grant from the Department of Homeland Security and some California funds. And like Jay said, it was just going to roll through.
Until people started hearing about it and going to the hearing, and the Board of Supervisors said no.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that that happened was that a concerned citizen filed a request for information with the Alameda County Sheriff's and got access to the drone records and got access to a memo that a department employee had written about what they wanted to use a drone for, and made that information public. And that's why we really push for transparency at EFF, and the ACLU does as well, because without this kind of information, we just don't know what the government's doing.
And what about the legitimate uses of this? Like, I think somebody said finding lost hikers or surveying crops or damage from a disaster like the nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan. I mean, there are uses for drones where you couldn't send in people.
Certainly true. And I think that one of the reasons why it's urgent that we do get these privacy questions that surround drones pinned down and taken care of is so that we can take advantage of the good things that drones do have to offer in terms of helping somebody, you know, a child lost in the forest or what have you, without having to worry that they're going to be turning into Big Brother. Often what happens is technology like this becomes tainted by privacy issues because they aren't addressed squarely. And so by taking care of the privacy issues and making everybody feel okay, that opens up the way for technologies to be used in the good ways.
And that gets back to this idea of public debate, discussion, and democratic control. Let's go to more callers. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about domestic drone use. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Jean in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The Peace and Justice Commission of the City of Berkeley has an item on the City Council agenda regarding drones. That's going to be next Tuesday, December 18th, 7 p.m. at Old City Hall on Martin Luther King Jr. Way. And this is they're calling for a no drone zone resolution and ordinance. They're asking the City Council to pass that and to ask the City Attorney to draw up an ordinance that would ban drones from the airspace over Berkeley. And we're particularly concerned because the sheriff of Alameda County is very interested in getting a drone, and we are a part of Alameda County. My understanding is that there wasn't a solid no to his request by the Board of Supervisors.
But it was tabled,
sent to a committee or something. So anyway, everybody is welcome to come to the Berkeley City Council and speak. You don't have to live in Berkeley. This is something that affects all of us, regardless of where we live, because it's going to be spreading if we don't put a stop to it. And you don't have to identify yourself or say where you're from. That would violate the Brown Act. The mayor doesn't ask people for identification. So anybody, all of you can come and speak your opinion about drones.
And that's at the Berkeley City Council next Tuesday, the No Drone Zone Resolution?
Yes, and it's 7 p.m.
Well, great, Gene. We'll put a link to all of that information at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. We've also got links to articles and all of the information from our guests there. That's yourcallradio.org. And let me go to Milo in San Francisco. Hi, Milo. Milo, are you with us?
I am. Hello.
Great. Yeah. Tell us about buying a drone.
Yes. Well, I was interested in this topic, but from a slightly different perspective, and that was not so much what the government and military might be doing with drones, but what regular citizens might be doing with drones. So without any previous experience, I went and pursued finding a drone kit online and seeing what I could do to create essentially an armed, weaponized flying device.
How much did it cost?
Well, the entire purchase price, including some remote control equipment and batteries and other devices like that, was somewhere just under maybe about $1,700. The drone itself, however, was about $700.
And you say it had a weapon?
Well, what I decided to do was put a first-person video transmission system on it so I could fly it remotely and see what the drone sees. And I wanted to put a weapon on it to see what that kind of experience was like, how hard or easy that might be. And so I actually bought a paintball gun that looks like a real pistol and shoots like a real pistol, but it only shoots paintballs. Completely legal, safe toy. But I mounted that on the drone and put it in the air, flew it around, tried to shoot targets, tried to shoot human targets, tried to shoot moving targets. And to my surprise, this thing was exceedingly successful at that task. I have no previous.
Did the people you were trying? Hold on one second, Milo. Did the people that you were shooting at know that you were going to do this?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
This was all a very much controlled, controlled scenario environment. And in fact, I produced a video on this whole experience because I wanted to share with people my experience of going from sort of the starting line to the sort of conclusion of this idea with no previous experience. And so I created a video, put it online. That's called Citizen Drone Warfare. And the name of this, the video series is called Dangerous Information. And it's I just released the video maybe 24 hours ago, so I think this is a very timely.
So, Milo, if you'll just, when you get off the line, if you'll just stay on the line so that our producer can get the information so we can link to it at yourcallradio.org so that people can see that. What was your takeaway from all of this? What are your lessons?
Well, it was a chilling experience, to say the least. I know a lot of people who fly remote control airplanes and other sort of remote control toys, and drones are quickly becoming a popular device to fly around for hobbyists. Completely innocently, they make wonderful toys. They're a lot of fun, and they do have some tremendously beneficial uses for people who are surveilling property, looking to maybe do things like dust crops. I saw a story not too long ago about a father who used a drone to walk his child to the local school bus each morning so that the father could sort of stay at home while keeping a video surveillance and video chat connection with their child as they walked to the school bus. So there's a lot of really interesting uses for drones that are entirely innocent and beneficial. However, it's not hard to extrapolate in our American culture what might happen once these drones are so pervasive and so available and so easy to use.
And yours was unregulated. You did not need permission from the FAA.
Excuse me?
And yours was unregulated. You did not need permission from the FAA for this. This is just a toy.
This is just a toy. I was flying it on private property, and I was staying clearly within the FAA guidelines with being in control of it, keeping it in line of sight, and keeping it under 400 feet.
But maybe not shooting at people.
I was shooting at participants, willing participants, and I was also shooting at inert targets as well.
Well, Milo,
go ahead.
I just wanted to thank you for sharing this information. We'll put links to it at Your Call Radio. I wanted to get comments from our panel about this, about Milo's experience and this private use of these toys and the dangers that he just illustrated.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this is that it does demonstrate that The FAA does regulate all drone use in the United States. One of the ways that the FAA regulates that is for drones that are used kind of like model aircraft. There, the FAA has regulations that relate to private use of drones. And as Milo said, as long as the drone is used in an unpopulated area, flown under 400 feet and remains in line of sight of the pilot, and it's not used for commercial purposes, anybody can fly a drone in that situation. There's a whole movement in the Bay Area and that's been expanding, this DIY, do-it-yourself drones movement. A lot of people from who've been interested in model aircraft for a long time have gotten together with people who are interested in open source software, and they've developed technologies to fly drones. Now, the interesting thing is that if you talk to people who fly their own drones, just for sort of from a hobbyist perspective, across the board, people will tell you that these things are actually pretty dangerous. Most people will talk about their experience trying to put their drone up in the air the first time, and the first thing that happens is it crashes into a tree, into the roof of the house. Some of them crash into other people on the ground. So it's definitely something to be concerned about, and we certainly wouldn't advocate for putting paintball guns on drones, even for testing purposes, and it's concerning to hear that people are doing that.
Well, it sounds like Milo wanted to test what could be done with this. I'm sorry, GW or Jay, were you trying to get in?
That's Jay. I just wanted to add, maybe you talked about this in the part of the show that I missed, but drones have been used. One of the concerns about drones is that the police uses them to watch citizens all the time. But they've also been used by citizens to watch the police, for example, in large demonstrations overseas where they don't have the FAA regulations. They've been used to monitor riot police and how they're behaving during a protest by citizens. And one of the things we don't want to see is the government using the threat of terrorism or other threats to set up a system where the government is allowed to use drones to watch us, but we can't use drones to watch them ever. And of course, there are serious issues, as Milo raises, about safety and about privacy from private drone use, and those are going to have to be addressed. But they need to be addressed very carefully, because we want to make sure that drones aren't, like so many other technologies, used to tilt power away from the individual citizen and towards the government.
That's Jay Stanley. He's senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. He's joining us from D.C. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the increasing use of domestic drones and what are the privacy and legal issues around that. We have a lot of callers I want to get to. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org when there's an open line. We're at 866-798-TALK. Let's go to Sam in San Francisco. Hi, Sam. Thanks for waiting. Sam, are you with us? Sounds like a drone in his line. Are you with us, Sam? All right, so then I'm going to go to Marie-Louise. Hi, Marie.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, now I'm even more scared because of what has been said here. And I just have to say something back to the thing about the father who has a drone watching his child go to school or to the bus.
Yeah.
And so pretty soon, I guess, we could just have the, drones watching our kids. Maybe we're not going to need to stick around them at all.
Drone sitters.
Anyway, that's not what I called to say, but I find that very scary. And also, I can just see all the maniacs that could come up with their own drone and maybe let that one go off into some neighborhood that they don't like. It's horrible. But I also wanted to say that speaking to our representatives, I think it's often about the same as speaking into thin air. And I think that we have to deal with things from different directions to really get a hold on this. And one of the things is to find out where the lobbyists are, who's paying them, how much are these companies that are involved in the production, how much are they making, and then get rid of these lobbyists that are paid huge amounts of money.
Well, Marie, let's hear from the panelists about that. Where is the money in this? Who's paying congressional caucus money? I believe that the Drone Caucus, a 60-member bipartisan drone caucus, has received $8 million in drone-related campaign contributions. So where is this money coming from? Who's it going to? And where's information about all of that? I don't know if, Jay, you're the person to tell us that, or Jennifer.
I could add something to that really quick. It's important to understand not just campaign contributions, but the number of people who are employed by manufacturing in not just this industry, but so many other defense-related industries. California, for decades, has had a huge role in the aerospace and defense industries in terms of the numbers of people employed. So in Southern California, a lot of people are employed making unmanned aircraft for the Defense Department. And as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wind down, those folks are going to want to continue to be employed. And individuals like Buck McKeon, a lawmaker from Southern California, represents a district where General Atomics is based, I believe, and that where a lot of people are employed doing this stuff. He would like to see to it that a lot of his constituents remain employed. So if these aircraft aren't going to be used abroad, he's interested in seeing how they could be used here so that in the end, he has constituents who are able to go to work each day. So campaign contributions are important, but his constituents are also going to be watching what happens to their jobs and what he appears to be doing for their jobs. So he's an example. Henry Queller from South Texas is an example. He's on the Drone Caucus. He has a lot of pressure on him to appear tough on border security. So since there's a big a border application for unmanned aircraft, he's been front and center on this issue. So those are the types of things you should be looking for if you're interested in finding out where power is concentrated on a subject like this.
And that's
contributions are one of them, but jobs as well.
Jobs and these industries. G.W. Schultz is an award-winning Homeland Security reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. We'll put links to all of his reporting at yourcallradio.org. I want to get to more calls and emails now. Jen writes, drones are incredibly loud. It's like having your neighbor's weed whacker going overhead for hours on end. I worked near the Arizona-Mexico border in the late 90s, and they were the worst. Sam in San Francisco, who couldn't stay on the line with us, said he's been seeing random flashes of light at night. Is it possible that drones are being tested in San Francisco right now? Jennifer, do you know?
We haven't seen that in any of the records we've seen so far. If you go to our website, www.eff.org, we have a link to a new Google map that plots out all of the drone flight locations that we've gotten information on so far. And so far, there's nothing in the Bay Area, even in Alameda County. To our knowledge, the Alameda County Sheriff's Department has not been issued a license yet to fly a drone. And so it was, even if they had the money and they purchased one, they wouldn't be allowed to fly it.
And let's go to Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Thank you. My question was about why, what are the reasons the federal government is so interested in assisting local governments with getting drones? And I feel I've gotten some of those answers already, but I also wanted to make a comment about one of your guests said that we have some protections about audio surveillance. And I just actually heard a report last night on Russia Today. They were saying that they're rolling out technology that does pick up audio of people, like in buses and transportation. So anyway, that's what I have to say.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Audio recording is an interesting example because there are a lot of regulations on traditional wiretaps, wiretapping landlines, but we know that people are communicating with a lot different types of technologies now than they are with landlines. So what matters is updating a lot of the laws that you see in place where at one time Congress was very conscientious of government overreach and intrusion in a communications method like a landline. And if Congress cared enough back then to try to shield civil liberties of American citizens who have done nothing wrong, why wouldn't they apply the same restrictions to a lot of the 21st century law enforcement technologies we're seeing, where you balance the desire police have to use innovation to be more effective and do their jobs better, but also shield everyday Americans who have done nothing wrong from data collection and government overreach. That is much simpler to do now in the 21st century because we can store so much more data than we used to be able to, and we can deploy things like drones in a way that we couldn't before.
And I want to get to, I'm sorry, we were running out of time. Let me get to Beth in Palo Alto. If you could be as brief as possible, Beth, just because we're running out of time.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just sent you an email through feedback with the article I'm citing. It's through the British Mail Online.
Okay.
And they put it back in June where... you know, here we're talking about the military, but it's actually some of the largest commercial corporations that we use every day, Google and Apple, who are now using these military-grade cameras to take powerful satellite images that they've never been allowed to do before, down to the point of where they can zoom inside windows and get 4-inch, you know, size objects. So I think, you know, we're just becoming very immune to this and to this kind of privacy invasion and surveillance.
And Bring Peace in Santa Cruz wants to know, what are the health effects of drones? Do we have to worry about electromagnetic radiation? Can somebody answer that? Anybody, Jay?
I haven't heard of any speculation about bad health effects of drones other than the possibility that they may crash onto your head.
Well, let me read one final email from Art in San Francisco. Okay, so the health effect that they might crash on your head and fall.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any other health effects. I think it's the safety issues that are going to continue to come up around this.
Art in San Francisco writes, I agree with your representative from the ACLU. Drones should be subject to democratic control by the people. The rush to domestic drones pushed by both corporations and government poses a threat of a dangerous expansion of surveillance by government against innocent citizens. So we only have a minute left here. Just a final question. What are your biggest concerns and what do you think people should be doing right now? Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, I think that one of the things that's become apparent in this conversation so far is just how we have this patchwork of privacy laws in the United States. And that's one of the biggest problems we have in this country. There's no overarching privacy law that would govern this kind of surveillance and would govern all of the new types of technology going forward. We have some kind of privacy laws that protect communications, wiretapping, other privacy laws that might protect certain types of video surveillance. But that's what we really need.
And Jay, I'm going to give you the last word. You just have 30 seconds advice for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I think that we just need to continue to make noise. I think that, you know, we have a government, an answer to Wanda's question partly. I mean, we have a federal government which is pumping money into the localities because we have a Homeland Security Department which sees it as its job to push surveillance of all different kinds, and drones is one. And we have to push back. We have to assert local democratic control. And that's, you know, basically the way that we have to fight back.
Democracy. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Jay Stanley, who's a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. We'll have links to all of their articles and recommendations at yourcallradio.org. Jennifer Lynch has joined us in studio. She's a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they filed a FOIA Act and got a lot of information about this. G.W. Schultz is an award-winning Homeland Security reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Again, we'll put links to all of their information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can continue this conversation by posting comments. And I want to thank everybody for your calls and emails, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What's next for legalization of marijuana? On the Next Year Call, we'll talk about the changing landscape of pot legalization in the United States. In last month's elections, marijuana was legalized in Colorado and Washington. But federal law still prohibits its sale and use. So how will these new state laws hold up? What will a legal commercial market for pot look like? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.